I have a list. I went and like internet stalked you a little bit. I can listen to all your podcasts and went back and like you talk, you know, obviously like Babel comes up a lot and like people want to talk about that kind of stuff.
Right.
Which like is interesting technically, but like personally, like I've been interested in what you've been doing lately in terms mm-hmm. of like this idea that, you know, I can do open source and I can get myself funded, right? Like as an independent, I can go out and get myself funded because so much of open source that I see is, you know, it's this corporate funded, right? Like it's right. either being funded by a global ad network or being funded by everybody's favorite binge watching of television service or what have you. But what's this idea that we can go out and we can do good work and do open source, but then also fund it, which is a pretty significant problem, right? Like how yeah. do I do that as an independent person? So that's been really interesting to me to watch as you kind of make that leap from, you know, being working at a corporation to working open source full time. And I'm really curious, you know, like how that's going for you and, you know, like the sustainability and stability of that process and kind of the future of it. And
where yeah, for sure. I think that is, yeah, a lot more interesting to me and I'm sure most people, because I mean, you can look up all this stuff about Babel and, you know, a lot of people can talk about the technical parts, but it's like that can apply to anyone. And I'm sure a lot of people have their own aspirations of doing something like this too. So
we talk to people all the time and I know a couple other people that have done this, like Andre Stultz quit his job and, you know, he is calling himself, you know, an open, like full-time open source. Is what he's doing, which, you know, like he maintains through consulting and doing gigs and that sort of thing, which is definitely an avenue, right? Like,
right.
Like an approach. But like when you start consulting, like you're just like you're taking a full time job, usually depending on the gig. So like it has its drawbacks, too.
Yeah. And I think like if the problem is a lot of the ways of doing this are not really maybe what you set out to do or specifically doing open source. Like, you know, if you're doing consulting, then that means you're doing consulting. You're not working on open source unless they're paying you to work on it, which is, it seems to be rarer.
Yeah. And I think, you know, like a lot of companies, like if they're like considering paying for open source, like they're paying for like a feature, right? Like they want something specific. And then a lot of times like that specific thing they want may not even like be in scope for the project, right?
Right.
Like, but we're paying you, so you should be adding this. And it's like, well, actually, you know, like managing that kind of stuff.
Seems exactly. Like, and that's just not, it just doesn't kind of goes against the spirit of open source. I mean, you know, maybe they're the thing that they want does apply to everyone, but it's just kind of a weird, kind of like a give and take. In my mind, it should be that companies should trust the maintainers to like figure out, you know, where they want the project to move. And obviously maintainers want feedback from the community, but maybe not in that specific way. And we want to hear that use cases, but ultimately I think the maintainer should be able to decide what goes in. And in some sense, all these companies are already relying on them to do it currently, like without paying for them. So it's like, there shouldn't be any difference.
And I think, you know, like the role of the maintainer is also interesting because I think a lot of folks, like when you think about open source software, right? Like the first thing you're thinking about is the software portion of that, the actual writing of code, where like in my experience, like that's a part of it. It's a huge part of it, like no doubt. But like then there's also this whole other part where it's more of a like a project management and almost marketing job, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I find that part, I guess it's kind of like a hidden cost or people don't think about it. And most people aren't maintainers anyway, so they don't really know what goes on. And I'm finding myself that's the part I don't want to say like more, like I think I like it more than the actual coding, but it's taken me a while to learn that. And I also don't really know that much about it. So maybe that's also, you know, exciting too, where it's like, oh, a different kind of skill set. Like what you said, with whether it's marketing or project management or just trying to deal with people, whether it's like on your own team or community.
Yeah. Well, and yeah, it's like you got to make sure the documentation is up. You have to, you know, like the code, the goals, the like coordination. It's like a facilitator role in a lot of ways to like connect and like shield the actual developers. And sometimes, you mm-hmm. know, like they don't need to deal with, you know, everybody's personal preferences all the time. Kind of that and helping like distill it into something that's cohesive, which is
right.
You know, any good, like especially something like Babel, because it's, I mean, it's driving JavaScript in a lot of ways. Like modern JavaScript is just, you know, fundamentally driven by Babel at this point.
Yeah, I think facilitator is a good word. You know, like we use words like maintainer, facilitator. I've used the word steward. And I think those words kind of give a different connotation, whether it's, you're not like a, you know, like the whole dictator thing where you're not like, you do need to make decisions, but in the end, you're trying to just like bring people together and figure out together how we should move forward. And you might not care about the individual specifics, but just like the overall workflow of what people do, and trying to figure out like, where do people work the best and trying to figure out, yeah, like they don't have to just, especially for like new people, but they're always trying to like, they want you to tell them exactly what to do, yeah. Which you can do, but it's like to make it actually like scalable and maintainable. It's like, we want you to figure out what interests you too, which is hard because the problem is that there isn't really a maintainer role that people normally take on. It's that you have to do all of them. So you are the maintainer, but also developer, because there's only like two people on the project.
Yeah, I did back in the Flash days. I kind of had the facilitator role in an open source project, and honestly, like it launched my career, right? Like you can, and it started with writing docs, which is like I listened to a podcast that you were on, and you talk about, you know, you got in and you just start doing the thing, right? Like this thing I understand, and I think that's what people have a lot of, you know, like you get in and you want to do a code commit or add a feature, like you're getting into a lot of like almost politics at that point, like where you have to like weigh all these decisions. But if you want to get in and like spruce the docs up and add an example, like it's the barrier to entry is so much lower.
Right. And they're more willing to merge it instead of like, oh, do we even want this at all? That kind of thing. So,
yeah. Like if you start talking about code, it's like, that's a deep discussion. But if you start talking about docs, it's still super important. But at the same time, like it's, you know, one, a lot of times core developers are less inclined to really care so much about the docs. Like, right. They focus on the, you know, like algorithmic problems or whatever.
Right. So most likely there is a lack of docs, so they're willing to take it in anyway.
Yeah, yeah. That's why it's a great, like, it's such a great, like, I can't recommend that enough to folks, like, to get out there and, like, look for that kind of opportunity if you want to break in. And
yeah. It's hard, though, because I know that it is easier, but at the same time, you need to know about the product or the code or how to use it, at least. So, and usually the people that know it the best are those, you know, core developers. It's just that they don't prioritize it. So there's definitely like a learning curve for sure. But you're right. It's definitely more approachable than other aspects.
One thing I kind of notice, and it's a little, I guess, negative on the negative side of the internet, and maybe it's just the internet as a whole, but like there's this kind of underlying culture of complaining, whether it's on, you know, Twitter or in issues and comments. Comments are horrible, but like I as a maintainer, as the shepherd of a project, like how do you like approach that, like people's like general, like the negativity that sometimes might feel overwhelming?
Yeah, that's always going to be hard to deal with. I think that's also like, it's not like people have a solution to how this works per se. There's like, some people might say something like, okay, maybe you start muting, blocking everyone and turning off issues, that kind of thing. And that will probably work for a lot of people, or, you know, responding in a positive or nice way, no matter what they say, because sometimes they're just frustrated or just misunderstood. And if you respond in a welcoming way, they'll realize that you're just a person or a human too. But I think it really depends on the situation. Yeah, it's like, I guess, yeah. I mean, I think most of us know there's no formula. It's just really hard. And yeah, there really needs to be some kind of cultural change. And I feel like the way we go about doing that is through, you know, kind of changing the environment that we work in, and I don't know, trying to change like the habits that we have, which are like how we use these tools, you know, whether it's GitHub or Twitter or Slack. And it's like the way we use them kind of changes how we act. So like one simple example is like the fact that we have like notifications, and it's kind of like email, where I like, if it makes you want to like look at every single one, and kind of like the whole inbox zero, but like same with GitHub, it was like, oh, I need to have zero notifications, and it'll make you keep wanting to look at them when you shouldn't be doing that your whole, you know, day or week, because there's just going to be thousands of those like all the time.
It's global too. So it's every day, 24 hours a day, not just, you know, like during work hours in the US.
Right, exactly. And that kind of goes into the implicit idea that if you're a maintainer, you're kind of like always on call, like, and people kind of don't, you know, people are going to message you a direct message or notification, like, hey, can you help me with this thing on every single possible medium? And then you make it so easy for anyone to notify you. And so there's that side. And then the other side of like, we all want to be like inclusive and open. And so those things combine together, and then you're going to feel overwhelmed, even if everyone is nice, which is a weird situation to be in.
Yeah. I you said somewhere, I can do this full time and it still isn't enough.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And to me, like, there's a lot of interesting correlations between like running an open source project and actually running a business. It's like a business, except like the payment model is just kind of almost non-existent. Cause like, you know, like running Egghead, this isn't like the first time I've ever had a business. And then, but I've, you know, done that role on open source, and I was like, man, this is very much the same. Cause I'll get, you know, it's like people have preferences. People want stuff a certain way for themselves, or they're just confused, or, you know, sometimes often even like angry, like maybe even justifiably so. So how do we deal with that and kind of like smother them with niceness, or, you know, go the ignoring route? Like, how do you, you know, it's like, because like to me, like the maintainer's mental health, or, you know, the business owner's mental health for the longevity of the project is super important. And if you don't have that, like if you can't stay happy, if you can't enjoy your work, then that doesn't help the project or anybody that's using it, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think thinking of it like a business is important. And maybe we try to like shy away from that idea, whether it's not wanting to think about money because it's complicated, or just thinking like, oh, it's just an open source project. But it really is. And especially if you're going to, you know, leave your job for it, it's like, it definitely does become, you kind of need to take on that mindset. Despite, I feel like most programmers not really knowing a lot about that or wanting to think about it. Yeah, it's...
Well, I think a lot of folks like look at the business side, and the marketing side is almost unsavory. And, you know, I think it's probably easier when you're on like a corporate open source project, because you're already dealing with that, right? Like you're inside of a business, and they kind of have those models, and everybody's making a salary and that sort of thing. Like you have to start being creative almost when you're an independent and working on an independent open source project.
Yeah. The creative part is interesting, because it's like, you have to really want to do it. Like, I think a lot of people would be okay with doing open source if they got paid, but like if you're not, then yeah, you really have to desire it anyway. So I know that changes things.
You know, it's like the word hustle, right? Which can have negative connotations,
right?
Or positive ones, right? Like it's you can hustle in a positive way, right? Like you're not hustling people, but you're out there just doing the thing. It's like you're on tour, right? Like you've been on the West Coast and you're talking to businesses. And I'm sure this, like, you know, part of that is to increase your funding and increase like the support for Babel and this open source project that we all rely on for our deploying our applications that pay our bills. So it's like, you know, to me, it makes a ton of sense. And I really like, I've just been impressed watching you and your approach to this whole thing. Cause I think it's pretty balanced and sane. And like, ultimately, like, it feels like I think you can be successful with this just from my vantage.
Yeah. I think, one thing I am trying to do is, while doing this, I want to make sure that I don't, like, I guess, compromise what I'm setting out to do. Like, you know, I obviously need to make money. But one of the issues I feel like I'm going to face, and I am facing, is like, you know, when you're in this business money mindset, it kind of, in some sense, goes against some of the, I don't want to say, well, maybe values of like open source, where, you know, it's not that you can't make money, but like maybe it will lead you in a direction that becomes all about money rather than about like people and relationships and helping people. And so, you know, exactly what you said, it's like, how do you keep that balance so that you don't end up doing something you didn't think you were going to do earlier, right? It's kind of like throughout the process of doing all this stuff, you might get caught up in how other people do things in a startup situation or a different kind of business. It's like, I think the open source way is more of a kind of like a nonprofit type of thing, where it's like you need to sustain yourself, but ultimately your goal is a little bit more beneficial than just like getting profit per se.
Yeah, there's a, in the corporate world, there's, I think, B Corps, which is a public benefit corporation, is one of the structures they have here in the U.S. that allows you to like build a business. And the idea being that, like, ultimately this business is here for the public benefit, and it's a service that is offered to everybody, you know, with kind of egalitarian access to this, which is, you know, that's what open source is. I think in a lot of ways, you know, I read a lot about free and open software and open source and the way, like, it was almost co-opted by corporate America in terms of, like, a lot of people accuse corporate America of using open source as a way to garner free labor, which I think is actually a valid criticism. But, you know, it's also pretty negative and kind of a cynical way to look at the whole thing. Because, like, it helps everybody, not just megacorps or whatever.
Right. I think, like, the fact that it's free means that people weren't able to pay for whatever proprietary thing. It definitely lowers that barrier of use. Obviously, the problem is that companies can get way more use out of it and they don't have to give back. But I think that that's something that's slowly changing, and then hopefully I can be a part of doing that. Yeah, I think with stuff like Open Collective, Patreon, and just, I guess, different examples, it definitely seems to be changing. And I think we just really need to change, like, to make it a little more like, once one company decides that they can do it, then other companies will want to continue to join them. So
yeah, it's like when you you'll see the tip jar with a dollar, and like it'll prompt other people to.
Right. And that was something it was hard to, like, think about, because I was thinking, I was like, if you don't have a lot of money, you would think maybe people would want to support you even more. And then, like, the psychology of, like, oh, if you have a lot of money, maybe they won't want to donate to me because they're like, oh, they're doing okay. But it does seem like it's basically the more you have, the more people will give, because it's kind of, I guess that's the same as, like, Kickstarter or GoFundMe, where it's like, once they have a lot, you are willing to give back to a something that is already going to succeed, or you think it's going to succeed. And if you don't think it's going to succeed, you're, like, less likely to help out.
Yeah, it's
interesting.
On like the business and marketing side of it, one of the interesting, like, pricing a product is super hard and it's very stressful. And the mantra is, like, charge more, right? The reason is, like, people actually, like, perceived value as this huge thing. Like, you can sell a thing for $10 and maybe, like, to you, it's like, it's just worth 10 bucks, which will actually cause a certain sector to not be interested in it. Whereas if you charge $500 for the same thing, then, like, these people are like, oh, this is a really valuable product. They're charging $500.
Yeah. I remember hearing something about that too. Like, say you want to sell your, like, sofa and then it was like $10, but then you do like $200 and suddenly everyone wants it. So yeah, that's really, that is interesting. And I guess because it's free, then it's even worse, because it's not even anything then.
Oh, people value free stuff so little. We run a photography business and we give away free photography. And those were, like, the worst clients, like the most demanding, the most complaining. Whereas somebody that paid the most money, like if they paid us, $10,000 to shoot a wedding, that would actually be a really good client. And they would be, agreeable, and they would look at the end result, like, as it contained more value, which is, it's psychology, and humans are so weird. Incentives are so weird.
Yeah. So then it makes me wonder, like, that's kind of like a fundamental issue with open source, because it is free. So we're always going to have, like, this inherent group of people that are going to act like that unless we change, I don't know, I guess the conditions in which they decide and use open source. I don't know. I guess part of my talk from Zeit Day was about how, like, when I first started using open source, you might not even realize you are. And the last thing you're going to do is think about, like, who works on it. Mm-hmm. So there's, like, just from the beginning, you already are not thinking about people and what's happening to the project, but just the fact that it exists. It's just not on their minds.
So are you familiar with Lynn Tai and her keyvalues.com? Have you seen this website?
Lynn, I don't think so.
So she runs a website and it's called keyvalues.com. And basically it's a job board, but instead of, like, traditional, like, sort by pay rate or location, you actually choose through a list of, like, key values that the company holds.
Oh.
Inclusion or work-life balance, or, like, it's a pretty big list. She has like 50 items. And to me, like, this idea of defining, like, as a company or as a project, like, defining your key values and then expressing them publicly, right? Like, these are our key values. This is what we hold. This is how we operate, I think is, like, a really powerful approach to, like, bringing in and drawing in community or coworkers or what have you, which in a big way is community. And that's such a huge aspect to open source. And I don't see that a lot. Like, I see code of conduct that kind of approaches the same thing, but really it's not, like, explicitly, like, these are our values, this is what this project is about, and the community agreed upon value system, which I think it's just interesting that I haven't seen a lot of it.
Yeah, no, I think that's really, really cool. I feel like code of conduct is more of a, like, it's almost on the negative side. Like, you're kind of assuming something bad is going to happen, but, and it's like, this is what we do when that happens. But this is more like, oh, these are positive values that we want to aspire to that you might want to look into. Which, yeah, I don't think people really talk about that or have any documentation on that.
Yeah. Like ultimately one of the, like, the coolest side effects to me of like the dealing with open source and dealing with, you know, like being involved with this has been, you know, like the relationships we build. Like, I've, you know, like true friends, like lifelong friends that have come from like collaborating and being part of the same community on open source. And that to me, like even beyond like the ability to get some software for free and build a thing on the internet, like the ability to like make friends, like, you know, and grow as a human in that way has been really awesome.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Like, I remember just saying on, like, a few weeks ago when I did go to Seattle, it was so interesting to be able to go to a city and never be there, like, for my first time, and then have people that, like, want to meet up or even stay at their place because I didn't have a place to stay. That's pretty amazing to be able to do that through open source.
Yeah, and you get, I mean, it's almost like an instant bond too. It's like you're, you know, maybe we've only talked online, but you meet and it's, you know, like meeting, you know, like getting together with an old friend and just, you know, like comfortable even. Like, it's been like time and time again, like it's not even isolated. Like, it's not a couple folks. It's been, you know, like dozens over the last like years I've been involved with this stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So getting like to brass tacks, like financing and getting in and like sustaining and having stability. I think the like part, like I actually have kind of a problem with the donation economy around open source and providing resources because mainly because of stability, right? Like,
yeah,
this month you can be getting a certain level of income, but next month, you know, somebody might decide to, you know, pull their contribution or their pledge. That's kind of the NPR model, right? Like public radio, where we don't really know what we're going to get next month. We're going to ask and we can have kind of an idea, but like, how do we deal with that? And what models are you looking at anyway to make your life more stable as an open source maintainer?
Yeah, I definitely experienced that firsthand. When I first did the Patreon, I mean, I was pretty surprised that I even got anything in the first 3 days. I had like 2,000 and it went up to like 3,000 a month. But what happened was after the first month, two of the people gave me $1,000 a month and they couldn't do it anymore. So that's why it went down to 1,000. So like one day it's like, okay, minus 2,000. So that number doesn't really say like what's going to happen the next month at all, like what you said. So it's like, that is a good kind of passive thing where it's like, oh, maybe it'll slowly increase. Like, and every month people will drop off and people will join. But yeah, you definitely can't rely on that unless, I don't know, I guess you've been doing it for a really long time and those people continue to give. But, it does seem like if it's not like a large company or someone else that's stable, that they're going to, yeah, they could drop off at any point.
Yeah, it's almost like a numbers game. If you have 500 people giving you $30 a month, you know, that's like 180 grand a year, which is, you know, that's like a really solid living wage. But if you have, you know, three people giving you, you know, a couple thousand dollars a month and one of those goes away, like it really affects it versus the like the kind of numbers game once you have
more. Right. Yeah. So it's like you want a lot of people giving you, well, not really giving you a small amount, but giving you an amount. But then it's just like you don't really know that many people. And then also you almost feel weird where it's like, why are the developers the ones that have to give the money to you when the companies could do it?
Yeah, and I saw you had like I think it's the Open Collective, Adobe.
Yeah,
went for a year-long maintenance contract. But that's pretty cool. Like that approach, I think, is interesting. Like the idea that the corporation kick in and over a period of time versus 1 month, right? Like a year is a different scenario.
Like, right, because they could do the 1 year and then like halfway through the year they're like, oh, we don't need it anymore. So it does seem like in terms of just getting yourself like started, doing the like bulk upfront is a lot better. Maybe later it won't matter as much, but now it's like, okay, that's really helpful just to make sure that we're sustainable in the next few months. And that was it. Yeah, that was a good, that was probably my first big, I don't even know what you call this, but like set of funding, because it was like, it's a big company. And then I guess other people and other companies are like, oh, we want this kind of service too. Then that'll be really useful if it's like a starting point. And also because it's not, and it's also not exactly like consulting where where I'm spending lots of time, where it's like kind of low amount of hours. So that's really helpful too.
Yeah, it's like a questions and priority support, basically. Would that the general gist of it?
Yeah, basically, like support hours.
So one of the things, and actually this is part of the reason Egghead exists, because when I first, like when the idea was sparked, it was John Lindquist had, you know, his 50 videos on YouTube, and he was giving away for free, which is awesome, and people do that. And I was like, man, you should really be charging for this. And he's like, well, I have a donation button. And I was like, you know, like it's busking almost, right? Like you're at the street corner playing your guitar and just hoping people toss money.
Yeah.
Which is fine, and people do that, and I think it's an okay model. But like my idea was, well, why can't we, like, if we're going to teach and we're going to share this knowledge, and obviously people will pay for that sort of thing, right? Like people like want to educate themselves. You know, that was where the idea was. Like let's do this, and instead we'll charge a fee and allow people access, which ultimately is what the business has been about, right? It's like content creators are able to like earn a sustainable income. Versus the, well, or in addition to the asking people for help, I guess.
Yeah. And then for Egghead, it's like not just one person's content, but like all of the creators. So you're paying for access to everything. So that definitely makes it different too.
Yeah. And yeah, it makes the value pitch to get people to sign up. Just, I don't know, like to me, I think education in general is a really great way to like finance what you're trying to do, whether it's workshops or, you know, even books and tutorials and that sort of thing is like time again proven to be a great approach to.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's just, I have like this very naive view or material for free, but it's like, I guess it shouldn't prevent you from making like paid content or that kind of thing. So,
well, there's also, so this is like getting back to more like business and marketing, right? Like there's this idea of tiers. A lot of times, if you're starting a business, or software as a service, a lot of times they'll start with a low tier, like the free tier, right? Like get this guide or get this thing. But then if you also want like these extras, you can get this, or if you want like the mega extras, you can, you know, do this amount. And there's a ratio, right? Like a price ratio, zero free, obviously you multiply that by anything, it's still zero, but, you know, just like this low barrier to entry where you're delivering value, you're giving, you know, enough to get started. You're contributing that way. Cause I agree. Like we have we have like 30 or 40 free courses.
Which yeah.
Like 30% of our courses are actually free, which I love. Like I want people to learn, and I think the world deserves that, right? Like the idea of like open access to education, but at the same time, like you have to have the premium offering or else like, how do we eat? That comes into question. It's always like a balance thing, like with everything, right? Like it's all.
Yeah. And I think it's justifiable in the sense that if the paid content is advanced, it's like, well, they already got value from the free stuff. And people are more willing to pay for something that they probably wouldn't look at like for free anyway, where it's like, it wasn't accessible before, but now because they have the knowledge, they're willing to learn more. That seems like an easy way to keep going with that idea.
Yeah. And I mean, it's like reciprocity, right? Like I've got free, like you're able to prove that you can deliver the value so they can like with much less risk, like approach it versus like some, you know, like get rich quick type scheme. That's not what we're talking about. It's like, hey, here's some value. You'll learn. We can prove that by giving you this thing. And then like, if you need to learn more and you want to advance further, then like with a little risk, you can give us some money and get the more advanced stuff, which like is, you know, fair and equitable. It gets tough. And especially with access, like globally, because like countries, you know, like on the African continent or South America have a really hard time paying like US developer products. And that's been like making it fair and equitable, like globally has been an interesting challenge that we didn't even consider when we were starting it.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. I think like the point about like not getting rich quick, but not just the quick, but I guess, or the rich part, but the, I guess it's like, how do we like show people that what we're about isn't like the, you know, something really fast or like hype or like, you know, these, you know, the releases and downloads, but like we're here for the long term. And it's really, I guess it's really about like trust, right? It's like, and making sure that, you know, from X years from now, this is still like a relevant, helpful product or whatever it is, which just like means a lot more to people than just like, oh, this thing is just something I need right now.
So This all kind of goes back to me, to my friend Kai Davis has an expression that he likes to use. It's living an unconventional life of my own design. Like your recent journeys really made me think of that. And, you know, like this idea that we live in a time where you can do what you're up to, I think is pretty awesome.
Yeah. And it took me a really long time to make that leap of faith, because everything about what we're doing now is just kind of like working at a corporation or just like doing whatever was there before. And then you never I think a lot of people have dreams of doing their own thing, but they're kind of shaped by what we see on TV or like Silicon Valley, that kind of stuff. And I remember when I was younger, I really wanted to do a startup, but then I was just looking at like how it's portrayed and other people and their stories and just like, you know, like burnout and just like bad work-life balance. And then later it's like, oh, now I'm kind of doing it again, but in this other way, which in my mind, hopefully is more sustainable, like physically, and mentally. So,
yeah, I mean, it's so important, like health and, you know, like absolutely like the most important thing, like mental and physical health is like the most important thing we can have, right? Like if you don't have those two things, then like, it's hard to have anything else, I think.
Yeah. And, you know, just to go back, like, being sick this last week, every time I get sick, it's another reminder to me, you know, like it's like just all those things that I cared about before don't matter at all. Like whether it was getting angry or other people complaining or whatever it was, right? When you're like not feeling well, it's none of that matters at all. It helps you think about what your priorities are. And hopefully when you're not sick that you'll remember that.
Yeah. I think that's probably one of the, like, you know, like breaking off and being independent, like how do you deal with being sick and can I still take vacations and how do I get breaks? Cause you have to have them, right? Like I think some people can like think they can work, you know, 365 days a year.
Yeah. You know, that's really interesting. Cause I almost feel like a lot of people that are willing to take that, so I don't know if that's true, but like if they're willing to take that step to do it on their own, they're probably people that work a lot or they're used to working a lot versus like just chilling. Cause I feel like if they did that, they probably wouldn't be willing to take the leap in the first place. So then it's like, yeah, how do you deal with not knowing when to take vacation? You probably didn't take vacation when you were working before. And so now it's like, no one's telling you at all. And you could be doing it at any point, but then you decide to just do what you're used to or the default.
Yeah. Right? I know it's been hard, like with Egghead and like trying to get a business off the ground. And when it first started, it was just, you know, like me and John, and I was doing, you know, like all the website and marketing and all that stuff. And, you know, I was doing long weeks. Even then I wasn't, you know, I was like 50 hours. I would never, like, I don't like being able to work 80 hours a week has never been like either appealing to me or something that I felt like I would physically be able to do. And I know some people do it, but I feel like you're kind of borrowing from your future self when you do it. You're like kind of saying, hey, I'm going to like use this now, but I'm going to like pay for this later.
Exactly. And if like what you said, this is like more of a lifestyle change or the future of your, like what you're doing, then you should care about the long term. And so the long term is definitely your health. So,
and like, is burnout preventable? Like that's the, you know, and like, I would say yes. And I heard, I think it was from, the Changelog, and you were on it, and there was a woman on it that was talking about burnout, and the, like, it's the same, like it medically, like the diagnosis is the same as clinical depression. Like burnout and clinical depression are the same diagnosis and like present themselves in the same way, which makes sense to me. I've been burnt out and I've been depressed and they feel very, very similar in terms of like how your body does that. And like, how do you prevent that? And how, you know, like what kind of regimen does it take to like, cause you know, like Babbel needs you, right? Like they need you as the maintainer and you're willing to do it and you enjoy doing it. And how do you maintain that, you know, kind of pleasure and enjoyment and, you know, making it something that you want to do long term? Right. Nobody wants you to leave. And how do we make it to where you should be able to? If I left, it would be fine. But
right.
Also, I want to do this for a long time. So how do I make that happen?
Yeah, I kind of feel like, I don't know why, but in the end, I feel like it's basically just a sense of humility and thinking about how your pride, like, the fact that I think that like people really need me is like, it's because I think that I'm that important. If I left and, you know, suddenly everything would be broken or whatever, that kind of thing. And even if it was true, it's like, I don't think it's worth the sacrifice of your current state. If you know, in the end, especially because like, depending on your health situation, you might have like actual problems, not just like getting a cold, but like actual issues. So I gave this example in a talk where it was like, when you know how you go on the airplane and you have to put on your seatbelt or you put on your mask first, and then you put on your child's mask for oxygen. And so you got to help yourself before, even if your desire is to help other people. It's like, if you can't even help yourself, then maybe everyone's going to spend all their time trying to help you too. So it's hard because you're like, oh, I'm being selfish, but helping yourself in order to help other people, if that's your actual end purpose or goal, it has to be part of the...
especially long-term, right? Like if you want to do something and you know, like, I want to still be doing this in 5 years, it's just so important to, and you know, like you can take it as I suppose selfish. And I think we should be though, like you should be, it's not to anybody else's detriment, but to like, you know, like taking care of yourself and making sure like your needs are met is absolutely important. And, you know, it's like, I see that with AK, and like, ultimately, like one of my goals for like, in terms of running a business is to make it to where I'm not as essential. Like that's, you know, like at first, first 2 years, it would have been like, you know, if I left and that was it. But now, you know, we've got this amazing staff built up and we're, you know, we have processes and stuff is written down. And I feel like, you know, if I left for a year, what would it look like when I came back? And like, I enjoy working. Like I really love, like I love to work. I don't like having a job. I love to work, but you know, like I want to also make it to where like everybody feels confident they can make decisions and I don't have to like sign off on everything and everything doesn't have to run through me. And it's not
exactly
this cult of personality around a single or small group of individuals, but it's kind of this collective thing that we're all working towards.
Yeah, that's so good. Like, I want to think of myself as replaceable, even though, or not even just so that means that like, if you're doing the same thing over and someone else can do it, then now you can think about more higher level, meta level things. So it's like, as a maintainer, the way I think about it is, how do we think about the more long term things and also the higher level things versus just like cutting out the fires? Because we could do that all day. And we basically did that for, I don't know, like a year after I, you know, I guess took over with some other people. At that point, I wasn't thinking about vision or anything. I was just like, oh, I got, and, you know, handed or inherited this code base. I guess I considered it a code base at the time. So all I thought about was fixing bugs. Mm-hmm. And then later when I realized, well, I guess nobody is stepping up and the thing we're working on is a lot bigger than just fixing bugs, then we should think about what the future is. And yeah, just to think a little bit beyond the code. And that kind of helped me to think, oh, okay, it's not just about code. You know, it's about like where this project is going as in the ecosystem and the people and all that. And I think that was better because the reason why a lot of us get so frustrated is because like we're so frustrated with the small things. But I feel like if we do have that vision in mind, then we're willing to take on those small, boring things because they're all at least towards the purpose that we agree with.
Yeah, I think developing my ability to say no has been also an interesting, like over time, like I can say no. Like at first, you know, it's like, hey, we should have this partnership. And I'd be like, oh, okay, we'll do that thing. And then like, now I'm like, no, like it.
Yeah,
that's been a big, and it was just, it's just hard. Like that word is actually hard to say a lot of times. But like to me, like the ability to say no has been like a big mental relief.
Yeah, I think I'm still learning that. I think I say yes to basically everything at the moment.
I think like sometimes there's some periods in life where that's great. Like I'm just going to say yes to whatever comes my way and, you know, like accept this and see how the opportunities. But like then, like to me, that was like part of the learning experience. Well, I need to say no.
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about like habit and the fact that like, yeah, like if you don't do it, then it's going to be easier and easier to like continue. It's easy to say yes because like I'm always saying yes. Mm-hmm. It's not like I have to say no just so it'll be like easier to say no. It's just that like, you kind of, same with taking breaks. It's like, oh, if you're working all the time, you never take a break. It's like the fact that we have vacation is good because then you realize like, oh, I am like finite. I am limited. I get tired, and that's, it's helpful to remember that like physically that you should stop. Mm-hmm. Same with like sleep, right? Same exact thing. Cause we all want to like not sleep or whatever. It's like just work all day, but
I got to get my 9 hours. and I didn't, I used to not, I'd go to bed and, you know, I'd do 4 hours a night for extended periods of time. And you know, I'm 44 now, so I think as you get older, it also changes too. But like, even just thinking back, I'm like, man, I probably would have just been, you know, like saner and more pleasant to be around for sure if I had like a decent amount of sleep. Have you read The Power of Habit? Have you read that book?
No, I haven't. Someone did recommend it to me. I read a similar book, but it was more specifically about like spiritual formation, but it was also about habit. It was called You Are What You Love. And I think it probably talks about the same stuff. So
Yeah. That's a, like, it's a, like, I don't know, for any of this, like developing, you know, like doing what you're doing or, you know, building a business or anything, like your habits or just like living a life, like your habits kind of define, I think, the, you know, a huge portion of what we do, good or bad, right? Like it's interesting because good and bad habits, you can develop both of them, and the process is actually very similar for both.
Yeah. I think one of the main points in the book that I was reading is that you can't fix bad habits by thinking differently. You have to create like basically new habits that replace them. And I think the problem is that we all tend to think that as long as I know the right things that I'll change. But if we don't actually do anything to change, we're always thinking that we're doing the right thing.
Another great habit resource is this Stanford professor, BJ Fogg, and he has a website called tinyhabits.com. And he signs up and he's basically doing research, and he's been doing it for years and years. But you sign up and he starts sending you these little emails and you develop like a tiny habit, like you want to exercise more. So instead of like saying, I'm going to go to the gym every morning and do this hour long routine, you simply, like, after you brush your teeth, you put your walking shoes on. Like, that's the habit you develop, right? Like this, like, how do we incrementally build towards a habit versus, like, you know, a lot of times we'll take on something and it's this huge commitment and your brain absolutely shuts down. Like if you're like, oh, I want to, you know, I'm going to go lift weights for an hour times a week. And your brain's like, I don't think we're going to do that. That doesn't sound good at all. You know, so how do we like develop these habits in like an incremental way? And to me, like, it rolls back to like building software, right? Like this incremental approach versus massive change. It
makes sense,
right? Like if we can be agile in our habits, and that's lowercase agile,
right?
In our habits and how we like work and do these small incremental improvements over time, like you get the sustainability. And if you're working in a positive way, then like you know, like long term, you end up with positive benefits and positive habits that you build over time,
right?
Which, you know, like that's to me, it's worked out pretty good. I know I'm a big ball of all my habits that I've accumulated.
Yeah, I think it's just, I'm starting off with just trying to be aware of what those are, because a lot of them are things that, you know, you don't realize that you're doing. So I guess that's a good first step.
Yeah, for sure. Like acknowledging and like, or understanding what it is you're up to.
Yeah, like what you're being aware of what they are. And a lot of them just are unconscious. So I think that's the problem. Yeah.
So I think we'll wrap it up, but let people know just where they can go and contribute to Babbel and to your Patreon to support your effort.
Yeah. So if you want to contribute financially, you can, my Patreon is patreon.com/Henry Zhu, which is just my name. Or you can donate to the project, which I can take out of at opencollective.com/Babbel. Yeah. We're also looking for people that want to get more involved as well. I'm trying to figure out a better way of doing that, because I feel like it's easy to just ask for contributors and then not really have the resources to, you know, maintain all that work. So maybe it's better to do more of a mentoring thing, but we'll see.
Yeah, mentoring, coaching, sponsor type approach is interesting, I think.
Yeah, like the whole catch-all, like, hey, I need 100 contributors, and then now you're like, well, now there's 100 PRs to review. I would like to, but it's just not everyone has time to do that. And then everyone else will go away thinking that, you know, we don't have the time or we can't help. And then, yeah.
You know, what's interesting there to me, like, you know, we have all these code schools, right? Like what if like mentoring or coaching was something that people could do where like, you know, they had like goals and were able to, it's almost like a Patreon like level, right? Like a support level.
That'd be funny.
Where they have to apply and they could send in an application and become, you know, like a mentee effectively. And like, I've paid a lot of mentors like over my years, like for both business and development. Cause I was 35 when I switched to development and I had to, like, I was like, I had four kids. I couldn't like all of a sudden be like a junior developer and like lose my salary. So I had to figure it out. And I did that by like paying people. And I did that for Egghead too. I pay people that know what they're doing, you know, reasonable sums of money to give me advice and help me out. But like, like somebody that's like gone through code school or is in code school and wants to do extra work, like that might be, that's a, kind of a, you know, something that you could do where you'd work directly, build relationships, but and it's almost like a support contract in a way.
Yeah, but for that person,
I would like you'd want to, you know, like application, you'd want to vet and make sure that people are like serious about what they're doing and
right,
like that right. They, it would be a good fit and all that stuff.
Yeah, because there's plenty of people that just message me like, hey, what's your view on like this? I'm like, I don't know anything about that.
I imagine you get people that email and message you. They're like, oh, can you mentor me?
Yeah, or they're just like, what are your thoughts on this project that I made? And it has like, I don't know anything about backend. Or if I did, it's not, I don't feel comfortable giving advice or talking about it. So
yeah, like, yeah.
It's just like, no, I'm related. It's like, the only thing I want to talk about is like JavaScript and Babel. It's like, everything else is like, I'm okay with not knowing about. So
yeah. I don't get it too. Like, I mean, like focus and, you know, how much stuff can you know about at any given time, right? And do you want to be an expert in everything?
Yeah, and I guess I don't feel that sense of like, I guess that's FOMO, right? Of like random stuff that comes out. I just don't, it's not really interesting to me or appealing. And
yeah, so my confession, I haven't even done a Hello World in Vue, for instance.
Oh.
I know it's good technology. Like, I know it. I don't need it. I'm like fine where I'm at right now. And I used to be, I would be, you know, like all over it. Like everybody loves this. It's super hot and it's obviously good kit. So I'd have to learn it also. But at this point in my life, I'm like, you know, I got a lot going on and it'll still be there when I'm ready.
Yeah.
I need that.
Yeah. It's totally fine.
Yeah. And it's fine. Like, I don't know, especially if things are going pretty good. And, you know, not that like in tech, we have to look to the future too. Like you always have to kind of have your mind on it. But like, you know, it's like Babel and JavaScript 5 years from now. Yeah, it's still a thing.
Yeah.
It's not going anywhere, right? Like this is enough of a problem for me that in 5 years, I will still be working on problems in this space. And it's like people are like that with entrepreneurship too, and the whole serial entrepreneurship. I got to start. Mm-hmm. I got to have a portfolio of businesses. And I'm like, yeah, you know what? I like my one little business. I don't want to have to ideate on new businesses all the time. I just want to make this one better for the people that use it now.
So. Right. Yeah. I think focus that's really important too. Maybe I got lucky and I picked a project that just, you know, it happens to be like part of the language. So in some weird way, it inherently isn't really going to go away anytime soon. So there's that. But I mean, I do like what it means and what it's doing. So, yeah. But what's weird is like in the last, I guess, few weeks, we've been getting a lot more donations, which is pretty crazy.
Well, your marketing tour is going to work, Henry.
You think so? Okay.
I mean, all these podcast appearances and going like traveling around and, you know, like meeting face to face and people will see you, you know, like.
Yeah, face to face, definitely. Although now, like, you know, I did that whole thing and now like. I don't really want to travel that much.
Yeah, well, I mean, you'll see an uptick and then take a break. You know, and you're basically in like a DevRel job.
Right.
You know, like that's kind of, which is good and bad. Like it's grueling, like the, you know, like conference, the whole conference tours. And
yeah. Stuff is, and also the conference thing is like, I really want to meet people, but I don't care about traveling that much or maybe I just haven't done enough to care. And it's funny, like other people in my situation, they're like, wow, you don't even have to live anywhere. And you can just like,
you live in New York. So like going other places is kind of like, it's
nice. Well, they're more like, oh, you can be, what's it called? A digital nomad. You like Airbnb everywhere and you don't even have any stuff with you. Like free. But I'm like, no, I don't think that's free at all. So
I really like home. Like I love,
yeah,
like the comfort of my house and, you know, like, my you know, collection of things that I have to make me more comfortable.
Right. And then like your family and your friends and the people that are in your city and all that, it's different when you have to like travel all the time. Yeah, like Salesforce, they're giving $1,000 a month.
Nice.
For nothing. And then Trivago, you know, that the same company that donated to Webpack.
Mm-hmm.
They gave them $10,000 a month, which is crazy, but they're gonna give us $2,000, which is pretty, that's like the highest out of any company.
Nice.
So like even with that, I'm already pretty good. I guess it just depends on like how we want to, you know, how do we like split it per se. I don't know how badly other people want to do this, so
I think like the idea like of having like the ability to be, you know, like say, I don't know, like bring on people and like actually like take on almost like contracts, right?
Mm-hmm.
like bring on folks for specific targeted tasks. That's interesting. Like in terms of, you know, I'm, at the end of the day, like if you, you're basically running it, you run it like a business, I would think. Like
just yeah.
The way you've described it so far, it's very much like a, like it's a similar to running like a nonprofit or a corporation or whatever. Like it is a business.
Right. Yeah. It is. It has been interesting. The fact that there are no companies that donate to my Patreon and they only donate to the Open Collective because they want to support the project. But
yeah, they definitely fun. Like, I can totally see that.
Yeah.
Me too. I mean, it's not like it's even doesn't really even make a difference. It's just the perception of where that money is going.
Yeah. And then, so this hasn't even happened yet, but this like, I got an email, this random company, like, I guess they're doing like a something with like crypto or open source, and they're like, they raise money and they're going to give like all, like more than half of it to open source. Hmm. And I guess they picked one of us as one of the projects.
That's cool.
Which is pretty crazy. But yeah, I guess that'll, I don't know when they're going to announce that, but it'll happen pretty soon. Yeah.
And I think like core JavaScript, and then up through, you know, like Babel stuff is workshops, especially mm-hmm. like on-site corporate workshops, and then even selling tickets. Like my max rate for that, like my record rate was $15,000 a day. And then like my general rate was $10,000 a day, and companies paid it.
And they're just like, whatever. Yeah.
I mean, you have to do a little sales. You have to like talk up, you know, like what we're going to learn and what value right. to bring. But like, there's so many right. companies that need like core JavaScript training. And once you give it, I gave the same training 30 times. And at $10,000 a day,
dang.
For a 2-day training, and I'd be like, it's limited to 20 people, but we have 40. Well, we'll do two trainings then, and you know, back to back in the same week. And right. It's fine. Like, and some people, you know, like, oh, that's too expensive. To which I always meet silence. Like, never make excuses for how much you're charging, and I always charge money, right? Like, if they're like, oh, that's very expensive. And then, you know, like that, just like that's a negotiation tactic, and it actually works pretty good because instead of offering an excuse, I'll just make them explain it.
Yeah, there is no excuse. I mean, like,
it's what it is. If you don't like it, then that's fine. Like, yeah, you know,
okay, never mind.
Somebody else. You can definitely find somebody else that'll be less expensive,
right?
Whatever quality they happen to deliver.
Yeah,
but you know, like you're confident in your product and
for sure.
The value that you're delivering. Like, there's no, you know, you don't have to like be a discount operator.
Right. And especially if it's like about Babel, like, I mean, who else are you going to ask to do it then? It's like, if you're not going to ask someone that works on it, then I mean, you can go ahead and do that.
Yeah. It's like React Router. I want Michael Jackson.
Right.
That's who I want to deliver that, you know, or whatever. Like, I think that's a great way, but honestly, it doesn't even matter. Like, I mean, that's great. Like, they can throw you weird curveball questions, but like, I could like, given at this point in my life, feel like, you know, like I could do a Babel workshop mm-hmm. with enough preparation and
yeah. I don't want to,
but like you add so much value to it, right? You're Henry mm-hmm. Sue, and like you say, who else would you want to do that? And that in right. itself adds credibility and makes it stick too in the company. Like having you do it is going to be like a bigger uplift. And like, you know, if you think about that way, like in terms of funding, like how many $10,000 a day workshops do you need to do in a year?
Right.
To,
like, cover you don't need expenses? Not that many.
Yeah. So, you know, it's like every 3 months you go, well, what it does is it removes the sales burden from you.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. I don't need to go to your shop. I'll accept any $10,000 a day offers that come my way, but I don't really need it. So like in terms of negotiating from a position of power,
You can say no, basically. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Like, no, that's fine. Like, it doesn't sound like this is going to work out, or if they're weird or they have weird requirements or whatever. Oh,
right.
And also always make them pay for the travel, like that's right. plus expenses, not covered expenses.
Yeah. This is funny. Like when we talk about it, like the workshops and just like all this stuff, it's like, it almost feels like it's like too easy.
It's not really that hard. Most people don't want to ask for money, and they feel like angry about it, and they just want to work a job.
Right.
And all that. And I think, like, you've already taken the hardest step. Like cutting the apron strings from a corporation and going independent is super hard, like mentally, and like doing that is such a like staggeringly difficult mental leap. So once you've done that, like, it's like, now I just have to eat. And like, you have knowledge though. Like, that's the thing. Like, you're an expert and you have actual knowledge and that will provide value to others. Mm-hmm. Like, so you're not selling them snake oil. Like, it's not,
right.
not exactly. ripping them off. And like, when I first was doing it, I was like, oh, am I ripping people off? Is this like ridiculous? And then I was like, no, I'm not. I'm going in there. Like, cause I would get called back. Like, I would have repeat customers, and that was validating, right? Like, I'm like, oh, okay. Like, they're calling me back, and I am an expert, and I do know this stuff, and like, I can answer their questions. Like, I've sold like support contracts, like email only support contracts, where you have like high availability, 24-hour turnaround on answering email questions for like $5,000 a month.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's valuable, right? Like, they you know, I would solve, like, if they were bickering internally about some sort of technical issue, like, they would like explain it to me. I'd be like, oh yeah, well, if you go with option B, I think that would be a better one. And that's valuable to them.
Yeah.
As a mediator, like, there's all sorts of small things. I'm not even getting into like the content marketing, which, like, sell content, like, you know, like, what's interesting is once you make like an egghead course, right? Like, take like Dan's course, which is 3 years old, and he's made like $250,000 off of that course. And like, that's amazing to me though, right? Like, he just had this little library. It was 90 lines of code at the time. And wrote a pretty, you know, like, it was tough recording it, but then like, you take that hourly and it's like, wow, that's really great. And so many people have watched it and benefited from it. Yeah. But, I'm going to get back to it. And it was awesome to meet you, really, and talk. It's been a good conversation. I enjoyed it.
Awesome. Thanks, Joel. All right. Bye.